Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm your host, Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Mark Schuler. He's an associate professor in the anthropology department and at the Center for NGO Leadership and Development at Northern Illinois University. He's also an affiliate at the Faculté d'Ethnologie at l'Université d'État d'Haïti. The book we're going to be talking about today is Humanitarian Aftershocks in Haiti, just published by Rutledge University Press. As many of you know, on January 12, 2010, an earthquake hit Haiti very hard, leading to the devastation of thousands of lives, as well as thousands of homes. It also led to an outpouring of relief money and efforts, well-intended, but by many accounts badly handled and often making things worse. The book takes us into one of the most fraught outcomes of the earthquake, which are the camps for thousands of people who lost their homes. Schuler's ethnography begins on the ground in the camps and exposes the making of fragility and vulnerability amidst do-gooders, NGOs, and local politics. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Mark, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
So I want to just jump into this book. This is not your first book about Haiti. Could we talk a little bit about how you became interested in the place and, I guess, in particular, the problem of humanitarianism?
So I was a campus activist with Amnesty International in the 1990s during the coup against Aristide, and a campaign about Haiti came across the desk. And I was also a member of a movement to fight racism in from Chicago, which was founded by a Haitian. And so all these signs pointed to an interest in Haiti. So I didn't know that the founder of DuSable, the founder of Chicago, is Haitian until I was a graduate student. And I was taking a class in world history with the French, the Cuban, the Russian, the Mexican, the Spanish, the Chinese Revolution, but not the Haitian Revolution. So the systematic way in which the United States ripped Haiti from our collective memory, and we're beneficiaries of the manifest destiny through the Louisiana Purchase when France lost and was losing Haiti. So that just sort of got me hooked on Haiti. Why humanitarian aid? So I was... After graduating from college, I was a community organizer for 4 years in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul. And to make a long story short, I was told not to organize to save a homeless shelter from being demolished because the group that wanted to demolish it was the funder for our hotline. So my boss told me, no, don't work on this. This funder, as a for-profit corporation, they left the city and they took their donor profile with them. And so they demolished the housing. They didn't build their new office that they were going to. They moved to another state. And so regardless, the people were kicked out, and we lost the money for a hotline anyway. So the question became to me, what is the impact of funding and government on non-governmental organizations or NGOs? So humanitarian aid in particular became more important after the earthquake. I had to do a lot of catch up after that because my dissertation, my first book, was about women's organizations, women's NGOs, and development funding. They're related, but there's some important differences.
Yeah, and I hear what you say about the absence of the Haitian Revolution when we were in grad school, because I had this very same experience, and
It's very interesting because I think that now there's a whole generation that's responded to that, and there's a lot of stuff coming out about the Haitian Revolution. So your book is really part of that. So in a lot of ways, the argument of your book, I think, is in the title. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you mean by humanitarian aftershock. What is that term?
Well, great question. So So lots of folks were experiencing the earthquake. First of all, people in Haiti don't use the word earthquake to describe the situation. They call it the event, or they made up an onomatopoeia, gudu gudu, to talk about it because they didn't actually say the word tremblement or earthquake. And most people in Haiti experience the earthquake as just the first in a chain of disastrous events. So people refer to the word disaster. They talk about what scholars call vulnerability. And they reuse the word so that the January 12th, the earthquake date, was the conjunctural crisis. It wasn't the structural crisis. So people have that language in Haiti already that maps onto Western, quote unquote, social science scholarship on disasters. But most people that I talk to who are living in, certainly all that were living in the camps, experienced the crisis as, the earthquake was the trigger, but there were the second aftershock of the humanitarian aid. So I was in Haiti 8 days after the earthquake. It was one of the second flights that the U.S. military allowed, private flights allowed to land. And what I saw, in addition to being, horrified by the damage, was a really beautiful solidarity. So I was in Haiti during the coup in 2004, the second coup against Aristide. And the countries, the divisions that ripped apart the country in 2004 were suspended. So Lavalas and the Convergence, and Aristide and his opposition suspended their animosity. Rich and middle class and poor Haitians were all sleeping together next to one another on the street. Most significant was the religious difference. So Protestants and Vaudoisans left their divisions aside because it was all about one Haiti. So in my neighborhood, I did collect some money for some medical. There was part of a medical team, but I'm not a medical anything. I'm just an anthropologist. So I collected some money also. And so we had money to buy a water truck. And so the people in my neighborhood said, hold on, Mark, we can't buy the water truck until we know we can take it. So they had a meeting, lasted, a good 90 minutes, and so long story short, they had a list of 31 people having 85 vessels of water, and precisely who has what vessel of water. This is a pot, this person has a jug, this person has a cooking pot, this person has a water bottle. And they calculated, okay, so we're ready. that level of organization and solidarity, I mean, not just solidarity, that's organization ability that is amazing. So that Haiti, so that there was a glimpse of another Haiti is possible, that Haiti was rebuilt on solidarity, rebuilt on, a spirit of unité l'autre, one helping another. That was actually how Haitians survived, and Haitian people weren't given the credit for doing that work, and they weren't given the credit for being the people that were the first responders. But that Haiti ended when the aid came, and the aid came when aid turned that solidarity into hierarchical top-down mini-me NGOs that are the camp committees, who are the conduits of aid and become all-powerful. And these are the committees that contributed to the problem of violence against women by transactional sex, for example. These are all-powerful organizations that could give out 2 weeks worth of food rations to women based on the gender guidelines. So that's why I'm calling it humanitarian aftershocks. And actually, I had called it another thing first. The title was actually clearer to me in Creole than it was in English. And it was another, gudu, it was secus, aid, secus would be the aftershock. So it just became clearer to me because I am translating this book into Creole so that folks in Haiti could critique it, to use it or whatever they want, so it can be accessible. And the title Secus Secus just became clear to me because that's what I was hearing in people's analysis. And so translate that back into English, I got humanitarian aftershocks. There's a title of a really great report, Gender Aftershocks, by a women's organization, Poto Femme Fi, and Christine Dadeski, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of things that I want to ask you about over the course of the interview that you just raised. But I think it's interesting the way that you describe the solidarity, and part of the solidarity, this really comes through in your book, is this act of thinking through the whole process, right? So if you're going to get water, you have to think about how whether people will be able to take water. And that's something that you don't see happening with a lot of the sort of humanitarian efforts. It's so interesting that that was one of your very first experiences, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I want to ask you about the committees a little bit later, but I also want to sort of talk to you about the something that you raised in terms of who you're hoping is going to read this book, because the book really reads as if there's a lot of urgency driving it. And we were chatting about this a little bit earlier, and it's the second book you've written about Haiti after the earthquake. And so I'm wondering if you see, it sounds like you see the book writing and publishing and especially translating it as part of a larger project of solidarity as the book sort of participates in that project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So who is it? So who is Envision as the audience, and what Envision is why I'm doing this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a book by itself can't do a whole lot. And what books can do if they're, you know, being pushed. I mean, so we've had the book release on January 12th, the anniversary of the earthquake. I hope this would be ready for the fifth anniversary, because the fifth anniversary was an occasion for, you know, a media event to say how have we done, we being, you know, quote unquote, the West, or the North, or, you know, foreign agencies. So I sent this book to some colleagues who work in NGOs, and one of them in particular said, "You're too nice to us. You don't have to apologize. You don't have to reaffirm our good intentions. We need to hear this." So I said, with all due respect, my first book, the title pissed people off, so they're not going to read it. So some people don't like what I have to say just because they're affronted by what I write in Huffington Post and now Twitter. I'm just starting Twitter. In 140 characters, you can't get to too much nuance, but a book, you can tell a story. And so who have I envisioned as part of who am I telling the story with, and who am I telling the story for? I'm telling the story with people in Haiti, specific people in Haiti, people that live in the camps, people that are frontline NGO workers, people that are directors, country-level directors, people that are actually foreign humanitarians that came and wanted to seek me out. Who am I writing it for is all of the above, plus people that make decisions about where money goes, so donors, NGO directors, students who want a career in NGOs, people that want to make use of this experience as their, you know, their notch in their CV. I was going to say a different phrase, but they're, you know, the must have. If you have experience in Haiti, you're golden in terms of humanitarian career. Bill Clinton and the UN Special Envoy for Haiti. And citizens who've contributed to the relief effort, because, you know, the United States, I don't know about Canada, but I do know that the United States, 60% of U.S. households contributed in some fashion to the relief effort, 80% of African Americans. And so in a very real sense, we have a seat at the table that we're not even sitting in. And so I'm trying to hail those of us who felt compelled to donate to say, okay, this is what happened. Here's the lessons that Haitian people are learning. And, you know, so for a document one, you know, some of the more difficult questions and ones that can't be slogan, you know, translated into a quick Huffington Post blog or a slogan. Yeah. You know?
So concretely, the book, as you said, deals with internally displaced persons or IDPs, and the camps that many of them ended up living in after the earthquake. And you anchor each chapter, you open it with a narrative or a little excerpt from a statement by a Haitian person who either lives or lived in one of the camps. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the process of interviewing and writing.
Ooh. Yeah, so I worked with a team of people. So I've been teaching at the State University of Haiti since 2004. I've been an affiliate officially since 2003. I worked with a team of Haitian students. So every time I go back to Haiti, I teach a class and I have students as research assistants. So a lot of the camp level, all of the camp level interviews were conducted by a Haitian student and or a Haitian American student, because I was teaching at the City University of New York at York College in Jamaica, Queens, which is a large Haitian population. So I had five Haitian American, some of whom still have their Haitian passport, students come join the students in Haiti. So they spent 5 weeks in the camps in 2011, a year and a half after the earthquake. And they went every day. So they got to be a known presence. They got to see what really goes on. They got to see, you know, the aid distributions, if there were any. They got to see happenings like the president happened to show up. President of Haiti happened to show up at one of the camps. Any kind of, you know, who are the people that are the first, you know, people that present themselves as, oh, I'm the leader here, because they're the first people that show up. But then, you know, you're there for 5 weeks. You get to see who really is. And this person just kind of disappeared. Unfortunately, people did witness acts of violence and stuff, as well as having to confront the realities of living in this kind of subhuman conditions. So the interviews feel gripping to me. I would show up. The reason why I didn't do it myself, A, the scale, I couldn't do this kind of work by myself, but B, as a foreigner, as a white person, as a tall, white American, U.S. American male, the only context people had to interpret me in my presence there is as an aid worker. So when I would show up, literally within seconds, there'd be 30 to 40 people staring at me, talking to each other, say, does he speak Creole? What does he want? Tell him this, tell him that. So my presence really was disruptive. I did go back to all of these eight camps after the first period was done, and I visited each one of them until they closed. All but one of them closed, so there's only one camp remaining. Now it's called a village. But I went to them 9 times over the next 3 years. So I got a sense for these people and places as individuals. So the writing of it, you know, I had all this stuff translated, you know, transcribed and then translated. So I just was trying to get a sense for, well, what are the themes that are emerging? And so had to make sense of what I found. And really, like, going through the transcript, some of those are really, I mean, chapter 2, I cannot read anymore, because it's talking about the day of the earthquake and the specific trauma that people had because they felt powerless to help. And that is how I felt as well. I anchor every chapter with these longish transcripts of these interviews with individuals that kind of set the tone. And then, you know, just kind of seeing, I could have chosen a lot more, but I just sort of said, well, let's see what people in Haiti are saying, you know. So I did quantitative research as well. It's quicker and you can identify, you know, patterns that you can't necessarily with qualitative interviews, but this, I really felt honor bound to, you know, if I'm taking 10 minutes of someone's time, I'm going to do something real with it. You know, so, and people in Haiti are intelligent. They have a lot of experience and they're the ones who saw what was happening because it's their lives. And so this book, I felt the real compulsion to write that story, not here's, you know, the journalistic story is where did the money go? And that focuses the attention on the foreign aid worker. And this book, it does not do that. And that's intentional.
Right. That makes sense. And so each chapter you ended up, as you said, putting sort of different themes in different chapters. And I found a lot of them quite surprising. It was really an interesting read. And one of the ones that I found the most surprising, that, and I, you know, done some reading about what happened sort of after the earthquake, but the idea that the aid structures actually encouraged the breakup of families, right? So that it was this idea of a kind of nuclear, a kind of standard nuclear family that would receive aid. And if that wasn't visible, to aid workers, then the families wouldn't get aid, or they would get less aid, depending. I found that really fascinating. And also what you write about the way that families just responded to that and broke up their households and sort of apportioned people in different ways. Mm-hmm. Was that surprising to you as well?
On one level, yes. On one level, no. The HuffPost blogs were coming out thanks to Gina Ulis, anthropologist, performance artist, Haitian-American phenomenon. She recommended to the editors, they were looking for other writers for Haiti. And so she said, there's this guy, Mark Schuller. He did this video. Look him up. And so after the earthquake, within the first 6 months, I wrote like 15 pieces. All of us were in that kind of very quick mode. And, you know, as an activist, as a solidarity activist, I was, you know, really focusing on the role of the U.S. government, because I'm a U.S. citizen, and NGOs that get U.S. funding. So I was, you know, maybe a little bit in the kind of where did the money go, gotcha kind of journalism. So I was seeing very quickly, so I got pushback. Lots of folks did not like what I have to say in Huffington Post, and I heard a lot of it. I'm sure I only heard part of it. People call me naive, people call me destructive, people call me, you know, just go back to being a professor, leave the aid work to us, we know what we're doing, and don't you know that Haitian people are lying to us, don't you know that Haitian people are cheating, don't you know that Haitian people, you know, will just do whatever for aid. And so, but the data was clear, you know, so like you could either... You can either look at it saying, well, this is an example of how blame the victim narrative, which is very, very, I mean, it's a racialized narrative. It's a gendered narrative. Since the U.S., I don't know how there's a similar thing in Canada, but in the 1980s, with President Reagan trying to undo a social welfare state, there was a welfare queen, a black woman that was getting free checks, you know, cheating the system. And, you know, that whole, it's a very continuous, very racist, very pervasive narrative about Haiti. Because obviously, anyone who went to Haiti would see that there wasn't progress being made. And so the first impulse is to blame Haitians, is blame the victim. It's a very easy thing to do. Haitian people don't speak English, they don't have blogs, they don't have computers, they don't speak, they're black, and they're Haitian, you know, and so that's an easy impulse, and I got a lot of criticism for being naive. And then I was hearing from my Haitian colleagues, like, yeah, we're cheating the system, but look, not cheating the system, they would say, yeah, we're doing this, but, you know, you set the rules for the game, and we're going to follow them. That's just being smart, you know. And then I was hearing from some of my colleagues that I've known for years, and like, yeah, this is a huge problem, because the aid workers came in and they redid our society in 3 years, when it took, you know, the Industrial Revolution 2 generations to do, you know, in quote unquote the West. And so they were really concerned about Haitian scholars as well as Haitian NGO professionals. And so it wasn't just about cheating the system or being intelligent. It was saying, these are the rules of the game, and these rules are totally inappropriate and imperialistic. So that part of it, I wasn't tracking on it. But then once I started to listen, you know, and you know, slow down a little bit, I was able to hear what some of the deeper concerns that my colleagues in Haiti were having.
So related to that is the committees, the formation of the committees, mm-hmm. And I found that chapter really fascinating. And you make distinctions between the kinds of committees and how they're formed in particular, as essential to how they ultimately worked. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that and how you came to realize that that was so important.
These committees became such an important piece of the aid delivery. They're extremely visible. you can't go to a camp without some guy, and they're almost all guys, showing up with a card that he made, you know, like a plastic, you know, they went and plastified a photo and said, "I'm in charge here. What do you want?" You know, and it's a lot of these people were nobodies before the earthquake, but because they spoke two or three words of English or Spanish, they were able to be the conduit for the NGO aid. A lot of them were also church followers or pastors to a specific circuit of humanitarian assistance that went through the evangelical organizations. Some of them were even rumored to be gang members. I didn't pursue that part. It didn't seem to be relevant at the time. And it did seem to be a lot dangerous to be asking those kinds of questions. And so I didn't require any of my assistants to do that. But you hear in whispers all kinds of rumors. And you know that when you're hearing a rumor, to take it with a grain of salt. But the fact that they're rumoring about it is telling you something as an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. But these committees were totally separate from the rest of the population. You know, my trick as an anthropologist is, like, I would just show up and unannounced. And, you know, these people say, "Oh, hold on, the committee person is not here," because they don't live in the camp. They have to drive, so that it takes them half an hour to get to the camp. It's like, "Oh yeah, you just came from your house. You know, you just showered. I can smell that you just took a shower. So you're obviously not showering here." And sometimes I actually would confront them on that. It's like, "Yeah, I don't live here." It's like, "Well, then how on earth are you representing these people?" You know. So these camp committees were the saviors. They were the ones that, you know, you had to have a camp committee in order to get aid. So that chapter talks about, in real detail, the formation of these committees in these eight camps. And they're all different in terms of the story, but the rules were the same. If you want aid, you have to have one of these.
But it sounded to me like the committees that formed kind of more, if you want to say, more organically, right, that came out of the experience of the camps, and people just started getting organized right away, those committees... Mm-hmm. You seem to think that those were more effective than the ones that were formed by NGOs, by people who came in and said, "You need a committee. Can you please form one?"
Absolutely. I don't seem that. Absolutely. For lots of reasons, they had the organic, you know, relationships with the population. They came to the area. They survived on their own. They did what they could with their own means to solve little problems. And they did. And they had the confidence of the population. They had the trust of the population. So absolutely, I think that. I could document that, actually. I could have been more specific about some of the results, but yeah, I mean, seeing people, I mean, obviously I wasn't there overnight to see to do the patrols, but I talked to people that did the patrols. They said, "Yeah, I'm just volunteering, you know, all I get is a meal, but I get the satisfaction to know that no one's going to come in this camp at night and steal anything, you know." And what do you think about the camp committee? "Oh yeah, this is excellent," you know, versus the conversations that I can have with people and said, "Yeah, who are they? I don't even know," you know. So most definitely. I mean, this, and actually, while I was doing this research, I was this was before I joined the board of the Lobby Fund of Haiti. But I've been aware of the Lobby Fund of Haiti because since my first visit to Haiti in 2001, I was, so I asked the field workers, "How do you assess the organizations that are asking Lobby Fund for money?" And they said, you know, "Don't let the leaders speak, ask other people questions, make sure you get marginalized people like women, like elderly, like people that may have some visible disabilities. But don't let the leader say anything. You just have one-on-one conversations. And if you're getting different stories, then that's a red flag." The other method is that, you know, Lobby Fund does not give money to any organization that cannot succeed at doing their own project with their own resources. Mm-hmm. So you're just dependent on NGO aid. You're just creating this dependency from the get-go. Mm-hmm. So I consulted with the Lobby Fund to have my evaluation tools. This is in 2010, even before the larger research. I mean, the more in-depth research. But so I had some indicators early on, and so those were how I got to those kind of questions.
Yeah, the on-the-ground ethnography is really fascinating, the way that you take us through the formation of these different and the dynamics in the different camps and the ways that that plays out. So I know that this book is not centered on NGOs. It's not focused on NGOs, but NGOs are part of the story. Obviously, you can't really get mm-hmm. around that. And one of the things that you point out that's really true is that, A, it's really hard to say what an NGO is, because mm-hmm. an NGO is defined by its negative non-governmental status, right? And B, that there's lots of different kinds of NGOs in terms of size, in terms of intention, in terms of where they're formed, all of those kinds of things. So if we can step back and say, how do you define an NGO? What's your definition? And then, you know, this is a pretty scathing critique, but is there some way to think about some NGOs as being better than others? Are they all a mm-hmm. bad idea?
Well, so I'm increasingly less and less comfortable with defining NGOs as a noun, as a thing. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of NGOs as a verb, as a set of actions, what they do, what set of relationships that they build. So in Haiti, groups vehemently deny that they are NGOs and are the most harshest critics of NGOs, but they do things like write reports, like create projects that, NGOs is as, so NGO-ing, so either do-gooding or activisting is the thing that we need to be looking for. So collective action that is structured, that institutionalizes things. So social movements, the word social movements is that they're going to move. So they that is their job. Move people, move decisions, move things, move activism, move conversations, and move themselves. Like movements can go away, and that's okay. That's a movement. So an NGO institutionalizes their claims. Make. I did a workshop at a conference on NGOs last November that we, 15 brilliant people in the room, like, okay, what do all NGOs do? And so we had a hard time, and we ended up coming up with a few. So institutionalized claims making, and really specific sets of accounting, representation. So these are the things that NGOs do. And so as a noun, yeah, okay, you could talk about big and small, international, local, grassroots or top down. All of these are important distinctions, but what do they do? You know, so that to me is more important, the lasting impact. So what I'm studying now is the long-term impacts, because both critics and defenders of NGOs make all kinds of assumptions of their long-term abilities to make lasting social change, either good, quote-unquote, or bad. You know, as I have a documentary video that's published right before the earthquake, so it was a very used tool after the earthquake to raise funds for groups like Partners in Health, et cetera, and local mission groups. So I personally screened it, and I always predict that people are going to ask me a question. You know, I understand your critique of NGOs, but is what I'm doing okay? Are we a good NGO? Is this a good NGO? I mean, that whole evaluation in black and white moral terms, I get it. I totally do. But my, you know, the response is more complicated. You know, there's a really great collection of articles that feminist scholars Victoria Bernal and Ingrid Paul Graywall published in 2014, theorizing NGOs. And so they're grappling with this issue of like claiming NGO as a, you know, from the critique of the NGOization from within feminist theory. So, I mean, some of this is it is almost as if, I don't know if you've seen the movie Wizard of Oz. Glenda first makes her appearance after Dorothy's house lands on the Witch of the East. And the first word out of Glenda's mouth is, are you a good witch or a bad witch? you know, and her response was, I'm not a witch at all. I mean, so that's a lot of what you could ask. Are you a good NGO or a bad NGO? And the reflex is, I'm not an NGO at all. So what do people have in there? So when they're criticizing NGOs, what are they thinking of? So let's document that. But the complexities of human action, the word assemblage from Deleuze and Guattari, that those are useful ways to think through. These are assemblages of people that may have completely different ambitions. They have completely different ideologies. They may be using the NGO for different purposes. So there's not one NGO at all. It breaks down when you look at it ethnographically. So, but you can document the actions. So that's where I've been leaning in my definition. So yeah, I am critical. And I have to be. Because the impacts of the aid, you know, it's not only where did the money go, but what did it do? You know, so it did a lot of damage. And that damage may not be permanent. It may not be longer lasting than the NGO themselves. But, you know, those are questions that demand answers.
And you admirably refuse to give us easy answers. I think that's an important point in your book, is that there aren't really easy answers. And, you know, you actually turn that onto yourself. You redirect the gaze at some points onto your own position as a foreigner. You talked about a little bit about this earlier, but I wonder if you could reflect on it a little bit more. And, you know, you have lots of moments in the book when someone arrives at a camp and the response is, oh, you're just going to ask some more questions and then go away and never come back. And why should I even bother? Right. So how did you and do you deal with that discomfort? How do you reconcile it in the book? Or, I mean, maybe you don't need to reconcile it. Maybe you just need to leave it there as something that exists.
Yeah. Anthropology, we went through a self-critique in the 80s, the feminists critique the critique. And so one of the responses was reflexivity. Ruth Bayar, Gina Ulis's professor, was to say just, you know, in standpoint theory and feminist theory, there is no objective truth. What there is standpoints. And to be explicit and honest about it is the goal. To be neutral is to be complicit. So some folks, particularly younger white men, think of this as, oh, I get to talk about my little adventure story. You know, the Clifford Geertz is running away from the cops in the Balinese cockfight story, which is okay, fine, interesting, but it doesn't reveal the research, doesn't reveal the processes, it doesn't undo the kind of positivistic fictions of this is what Haitian culture is. This is what, you know, Dominican family structure is. This is what Rwandan religious ritual is. That was the old school anthropology texts, where, you know, these are fictions crap and sonorous terms, and that's fine. But the discomfort that I was experiencing doesn't go away. It shouldn't go away. It is anyone who wants to do this kind of work has to interrogate why we want to do this kind of work. What kind of motivations do I have? And what am I getting out of this? You know, and, you know, unfortunately, the world system is as it is. You know, I was launching this book at the Haitian American Museum of Chicago, and someone just said, thank you for your work. I said, why are you thanking me? You know, like, you should be asking, why is it that a foreigner is the one that has to be validating Haitian people's experience? Why can't Haitian people do that on their own? Why does it require me to document this and to justify and to give voice and to say this is a valid perspective? Because the world system is that it is, the inequalities that I still benefit from, even if I choose not to ignore, if I choose to ignore that, my U.S. passport gets me out of danger. My, you know, U.S. government is keeping people out of this country. My U.S. government is sustaining this middle-class consumption lifestyle that is killing the planet while making other people not able to do that through specific policies and specific ways that the you know, debt, we call it structural adjustment yesterday. Today it's called, you know, other things like development policy loans. But, you know, I benefit from this system. You know, my parents moved to the suburbs to avoid living in the city because I saw that I could have a good education. That was racist. I benefit from racism. We need to interrogate that. I can pretend it doesn't exist. You know, I could just sort of say, okay, I'm just doing good. Or then it would be part of the problem. So in the book, I hope that some of my non-anthropology colleagues will forgive the sociologist, one person in particular said, you talk about yourself too much, Mark. You know, and I'm like, well, maybe I do. And if so, I tried to keep the focus on Haiti. I also tried to keep my perspective there so that people could challenge me and say, I think something else. And so I'm just giving you all the details I think is necessary for you to evaluate what I'm saying.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you if you're arguing for the kind of curbing of the humanitarian impulse, right? Because I think it's pretty inevitable. We see something like the news of that earthquake or even the more recent one in Ecuador,
right,
or anything.
Right.
And the impulse is, oh, I'm going to, you know, get online, give $10, $20, yeah, whatever I can.
Right.
Everybody says it helps. So I was going to ask you if we should just curb that impulse. But now I'm thinking I should ask you if we should go ahead with that, but in a much more thoughtful and reflective manner.
Right. Right. Whew. If we felt the death of children for lack of water, sanitation, or food in Lesotho or Bangladesh, if we felt climate change in the forest destruction of communities in Alaska and Tuvalu, if we felt that in our gut that this is a part of the problem and that we as a species, we as humanity need to respond because it's a crisis, if we felt that, you know, President Johnston declared a war on poverty in order to marshal that public opinion that this is going to be a problem for U.S. society. Definitely worth worth a critical review as to how well that was waged, and definitely wasn't successful in many ways. But you know, the attempt to call it a war on poverty suggests that there is something about the photo op that, you know, that which is justifying the humanitarian impulse, the disaster narrative. The book chapter that I wrote since writing this book talks about theorizing a disaster narrative. Haiti's earthquake was like Benedict Anderson's global imagined community, that this was, you know, fashioning us as a global humanitarian subject, as a global humanitarian community. And that is good. That is precious. That those moments of human solidarity, I think, are worth doing. But do we feel the same sense of impact? You know, when there was terrorist attacks in Paris and then Brussels, and they killed X number of people, and then the same week in Pakistan, twice as many people died that nobody cares about, yeah, because they're brown or subjugated or colonized people. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. So it does require, unfortunately, something like a disaster narrative to get us to be generous. And so we need to respond in the Haitian terms, conjunctural crisis, but we also need to feel that same level of urgency about climate change, about poverty, about structural racism, about environmental racism, etc. And until we can do that as a species, unfortunately, I think we're going to have to be stuck with this humanitarian impulse. So how do we do it responsibly? That's what I'm trying to get at. And maybe that didn't come through in the book.
I think so. I'm actually one of the, as we get towards the end of the interview, I want to ask you about getting back to Haiti, sort of. It's not a book that leaves people entirely without hope, right? There are a few hopeful things that you talk about in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can just mention a couple of those.
Right, right. That was a choice as an author as well, because I was trying to document Haitian people's analysis and Haitian people's successes whenever possible. And I know I'm going to be criticized for not going far enough. In my first book, lots of colleagues in Haiti think that I'm a reformist. I'm not radical enough because I don't say NGOs all have to go tomorrow. And in fact, this was repeated a few weeks ago at the Haitian American Museum, where people really do feel like, okay, the solution is NGOs all go tomorrow, you know. Why did I choose this? So there is hope. There is. I chose to say, well, what do Haitian people learn? What was the import of the solidarity? What lessons does humanity, or should humanity, have taken from this experience? And so there are some, and you know, there's some specific suggestions on how to improve to rip humanitarianism from empire, you know, to make humanitarianism. There's always been a debate, humanitarian to development continuum, and so you know, you've got to have humanitarian interventions in the development framework. Because Haiti was quote unquote stunted in the relief phase, that's because of racism. And you know, you have to think in terms of the context. If the government didn't have the capacity, well, then give it the capacity. So those are specific suggestions. You know, humanitarian aid was about life saving. Assistance is way more expensive because logistics are more expensive. So contract that out. There's some specific suggestions. Also, some success stories in Haiti, like in Gracier, where humanitarian agencies have to negotiate with the local NGO. And the NGO became an NGO officially in the process in order to create jobs, to create a factory, to do that kind of scale up of that work. But because they have an organic relationship with the population, and because they've been there for 30 years, because they know the field, because they know have a relationship with the people, they know what to defend. And most humanitarian agencies were not used to working with them as locals. But so the conclusion ends with this experience. And I use his real name, Chine Jean-Baptiste, because the group Itika, their experience is so singular that I couldn't have talked about it without naming them. So I figured, why not name him? And he said he's okay with it. So those experiences about success stories are important. And the very end quote, you know, was saying, you know, we need to take stock and do better next time. That's not saying, you know, humanitarianism should go away. It's actually a real humanitarianism would require something like an anthropological imagination with radical empathy that we are all people. If you look again or differently at the struggles like Black Lives Matter, you'll see that some of these are the same struggles, that, you know, who gets to be considered human, whose humanity matters, whose lives matter. And these are, you know, these specific nodes of connections of solidarity, I think, are hopeful.
So we've taken up a lot of your time and you've given us a lot to think about. And one final question, which is, what's next for you? What are you working on?
Just launched a website, Anthropolitics. I'm starting to feel what it's like to be tenured so I can be a citizen again and not just not afraid to write what I think. So that's activist, you know. So do the Margaret Mead thing of taking what I learned from the field back home, but also be more specifically engaged citizen. When I say the word citizen, it can mean bad things too, like exclusion. In certainly the United States, when we're talking about the wall, and in Europe now with the crisis of, you know, the Syrian refugees, but citizen in the more engaged sense, you know, that. But my scholarship, so I have a 5-year grant to study the long-term impacts of humanitarian aid, of NGO aid. So there's 8 field sites. I'm going to take 8 graduate students from the United States, pair them with 8 graduate students in all across the south of Haiti. Half the field sites had NGOs before the earthquake, half did not. Half of them were impacted by the earthquake, half would not. So it's another structured, you know, what we call purposive sample. So 5 years of data collection, very, very big, very complicated logistically research, and I'm kind of nervous about it. But hopefully they'll get some answers about, you know, what power do NGOs actually have. And so theoretically there's some projects I'm finishing up. I am trying to document, theorize the humanitarian impulse. But I'm also talking about anthropolitics, the radical empathy, you know, the politics of the people power, what it means to be human. And I'm trying to sharpen what I mean by anthropological imagination. So these are theoretical projects while the big data is being collected.
Those sound like fantastic projects.
Always fun.
Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman, and I hope you can join me next time.